We're going to look at the whole nature of our emotions, talking about acknowledging our emotions, moving in to see how God would bring some healing to those emotions, especially as they relate to our past. One of the first experiences that I ever had with dealing with these kind of conflicts, spiritual conflicts, was a little girl, maybe 15 or so years ago, who was trooping around from church to church. She was a graduate of one of our local universities, 26 years old, actually finished her teaching credentials, but for the last 5 years had been institutionalized 3 different times and was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. She had a little tear-stained Bible, literally, like you'd let water on it and the pages were crinkled up. She looked like a little flower child out of the 60s, no shoes, tattered jeans, and came to Bible Study Fellowship, was in our church, had gone a number of times to talk to the leader of that, and the leader had asked if I would see her. Well, I was fresh out of seminary and had very little formal training in terms of counseling, none in this area, none whatsoever. I had a college ministry at the time in a major church, so we sat down and we talked, and I asked about her life, and it was just fragmented. She had trouble reconstructing the last few years of her life. Gave her a simple battery of tests to see if she could respond to any of them. She could not. So, what am I to do? Well, I looked at her, and for some reason I just simply said, I would like you to come back again, but I want you to come under the authority of the local church here. As soon as I said that, she said, I've got to get out of here. And she grabbed her purse, turned away from me, and started to walk out the door. And why, I don't know, but instinctively I said, is Jesus your Lord? She turned around and through clenched teeth, you ask Jesus who my Lord is, and walked out. Well, I followed her down the staircase. I was on the second floor, kept asking the same thing. Down at the bottom of the staircase, she stopped, turned around and looked at me, and she said, you ask Jesus who my Lord is. I said, is Jesus your Lord? Her whole countenance changed, and she said, yes. I said, can we go up and talk? Sure. We went up and talked. I went for some help. There was none there. I was all alone about 5:30 in the afternoon. And I looked at her, I said, there's a battle going on for your mind. Has anybody ever talked with you about this before? And she said, no, either they didn't know or they were afraid. But she knew. Now, I'm a complete novice. I've had no training. I've read no books in this area. I wanted desperately to help this girl. So we continued to meet and to talk. She'd look at me and say, you changed just now. Well, in her bizarre orientation, I didn't know what. So she tried to describe to me what I looked like and how I changed, and it didn't seem to make any sense at all. So I said, well, keep telling me when I've changed. And she did that 3 or 4 weeks. Well, about the 4th week of that, all of a sudden realized, because of her hypersensitivity to the spiritual world, I was changing. That girl knew when I was ministering to her in the power of the Holy Spirit, or I was just giving her some intellectual response or exercise. I tell you, it was interesting for me to have that own self-awareness. All of a sudden, I felt like, whoa, man, I'm at a disadvantage here. But boy, what feedback to your own life. My wife used to give that to me. She'd watch me preach, and she's got a discerning spirit. Boy, she knew when this was old Neil Anderson, the engineer, or Neil Anderson, child of God. It's kind of humbling to have your wife sit up and go. It's humbling, but it's good. It's very, very healthy, to be honest with you. Well, I was committed to see if somehow I could help this girl. And we just scratched, just looked and drove around. I said, because at that time, I thought, well, if your problems are here, it's because you were either involved in the occult or you got some major moral problem. So I looked at the moral area first. Nothing. Nada. This girl had gone at that time, this is 15 years ago, Gothard had just come out. She'd gone to him 7 times. She wrote little notes back of asking forgiveness of somebody who stole her tricycle and all kinds of stuff. I mean, she covered every conceivable base. She didn't need a Messiah. She worked it out herself. It was incredible. No moral problems is what I'm saying. None whatsoever. Living with her mother. Well, were you ever involved in the occult? No. No occult. None whatsoever. not even remotely so, never even read a book in that area. I'm really scratching my head. But her problems all began when her father, who was a noted pediatrician, divorced her mother, ran off with the nurse. Everybody else in the family were non-Christians. They just expressed their emotion. They got mad, frustrated, yelled and screamed, but not her, you see. She had to be a good witness. So she kept silent about it. She was quiet. Never told anybody. I'm going to be the loving, conciliatory person in this whole thing. Meanwhile, what's going on inside? She's getting more and more and more tore up. I said, let's talk about your dad. I ain't going to talk about my dad. If you talk about my dad, I'm getting out of here. I said, just a minute. If we can't talk about your dad here, where can you? If you can't deal with those tough emotional issues here, where can you? Well, that was part of our desensitizing time, but I put a couple passages together at that time that began to be the key to unlock something for this girl's life. This started about January or so that year. And they're rather intriguing. One's in Ephesians chapter 4 where it says, be angry, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Next verse, don't give the devil a place in your life. Literally, it means a place. New American Standard, I think, translated as opportunity. But they used to put a little number by it. It said, look in the column. Literally, it means a place. Speak the truth for remembers of one another. Be angry, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Don't give the devil a place. In 1 Peter 5:7, cast your anxiety unto Christ because he cares for you. Be alert, be a sober spirit, for the devil prowls around like a hungry lion seeking for someone to devour. Now, isn't that interesting? Right after how we're supposed to deal with our anger and how we're supposed to deal with our anxiety are two sober warnings about not giving the devil a place. I mean, I could be a little crass here and just simply say, if you don't know how to deal with your anger and your anxiety, there is a good chance you may give Satan an opportunity. Which was, in my way of thinking, entirely her case. Well, as we desensitized that, began to talk about her father, she worked through the issues of forgiveness, which was the major crux of this thing by far. Within a matter of months, that girl who was given up by psychiatrists left to wander the streets until hospitalization would come again. Worked in our church, in our children's program, by the end of the summer, up at Hume Lake, around that old fire ring on Friday night, shared her testimony to 400 high schoolers. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house, including mine. Now that's a kind of an interesting case, because I didn't know what I was doing in those days. I wished I did. I could have resolved that thing so much easier and faster for her and so much more lasting. But it started my whole way of thinking. Are our emotions our enemies here? Absolutely not. I believe the emotional part of my life is just as valuable to me as my thinking part of my life. I like to liken our emotions are to our soul what our feelings are to our physical body. If I could take away the sensation of physical pain, where you would never have to feel physical pain again, would you come to me and ask for it? A little reflection would say, oh no, no way. That's like leprosy. Leprosy is really a disease of the nervous system, I'm told. It isn't the skin that falls apart. What happens is you can't feel anymore. So in some of these backward countries, they walk around and step on nails and cut themselves and touch glass, and next thing you know, their skin becomes infected and boiled and whatever else. But that's like when I had my first knee surgery from the old sporting days. They went and put a big old moonside cut right in here, and it cut right across the nerve, and I didn't feel anything here for the longest time, at least on the surface. I used to watch TV or something and cross my legs and put my coffee pot on my knee. I could almost smell it after a while. I had a brown ring on my skin. Well, I couldn't feel it, see? But if you couldn't feel the sensation of pain, you wouldn't have really no mechanism to protect yourself. You'd put your hands in fire. And if you don't have some of those, quote, negative emotions, your soul would probably be destroyed in a period of time. Those are God's indicators to us as to what's going on inside. Not to be rejected, we accept them as part of our humanities. I personally look at the moral part, or the emotional part of my life is just amoral. They're neither right nor wrong. They just simply are. They're part of my humanity. And I'll say this before, I'll say it again and again probably, that it is such a critical part that if I learn how to deal with those things properly, it's a part of my life that is part of my being real and human. I'm not just an automaton, just a machine that rotely responds back to God in terms of my mind only. So I thank God, first of all, for the fact that I can feel and cry and weep and rejoice and all those type of things. That's what makes me different from an animal or a machine. Part of my humanity, part of Christ's when he was here. He cried too. And he wept over Jerusalem. And he experienced all the emotions that you and I would experience. I'm convinced of that. I think God has an emotion, don't you? We know of his wrath. We also know of his joy and his love and the apple of his heart and those type of things. So we're created in the image of God, and that's part of it. It's not something I wish I never had an emotion. You'd stop being, to be honest with you. Your life would just be meaningless to you in a short period of time. But obviously God says here that this is an important part of your heart, life, for we're to watch over our heart with all diligence, for from it flow the issues of life. Now, don't get caught in the theological trap here where you make the heart your emotions. That's really not true. In fact, every reference to the word heart that I know of in the Old and New Testament, it includes 2/3 of the time the faculty of reasoning. The heart is better understood as the seat of reflection, not emotion. As a man thinketh where? In his heart, so is he. We're told to do something with it, however. I don't personally believe, even though I use the term, that you can manage your emotions. You really don't. You manage your thought life. That's what you do. But there is a way that we can learn how to manage the emotional part of our life, where it can be a tremendous benefit to us in the way that God has created us. Somebody has likened our emotions to be like the red indicator light indicating oil pressure. There's several ways that you can respond to when that light comes on. One would be a little ball peen hammer. Ping! There, it's out. That's what I call indiscriminate expression. Or you can put a piece of tape over it. There, it's out. Suppression. Or you can look under the hood, which is what the light is intended to do. I call that acknowledgement. Now let's look at those three options here for a moment and see what happens if we share in either one of those. First of all, that is suppression. I kind of combine suppression, repression. Repression is an unconscious denial. Suppression is usually understood as a conscious denial. I'm choosing not to deal with it. I'm ignoring how I feel, for instance. But I want to suggest to you, first of all, that's just simply unhealthy. Even in Psalm 32, it's related to a sin issue, but he talks about the fact when I kept silent about my sin, my body groaned away. That silence wasn't the response to this thing that God had intended here. Then he tells us later, he says, turn to God in a time when thou mayest be found, because surely in a flood of great waters, you won't find him. It's not that God is not findable, you won't turn to him. That's the problem. When you get down to an emotional state, where you've lost control, it's emotions that control and govern your life now, not God. That's the problem, see? So turn to God in a time when thou mayest be found, because surely in the flood of great waters you won't find it. Psalm 39. Listen. I said, I will guard my ways that I may not sin with my tongue. I will guard my mouth as with a muzzle, while the wicked are in my presence. I was dumb and silent. In other words, I just froze up. I wasn't going to express anything here. I refrained even from good, and my sorrow grew worse. Predictable. That's not God's answer to this thing. It's not only unhealthy for you, it really destroys relationships after a period of time. Because typically what's communicated in any relationship is more on that feeling level than on the verbal level. Learning to express how we feel is an important part of our relationships today. How you doing? Fine. How you feel? Okay. Fine. Are you mad? No. You know, when you do studies on communication, you realize that when the verbal doesn't match the nonverbal, what do you believe? He believes the nonverbal. You sense that. It comes through. It's communicated whether we like it or not. You really can't hide your feelings. But by and large, you see, if I don't share what's going on in there, I'll make it up. If I don't know what you're thinking, I'll think what you're thinking. I'll make assumptions here. And we have a tendency, humanly, to assume the worst. Why is he mad at me? Did I do something wrong now? You know, let me illustrate that. Your children go out at night, and they're supposed to be home at 10, 12 o'clock, they're not home. Oh, they stopped off at the church and prayed, didn't they? Do you assume that? No, you don't assume that. You assume everything else but that. And even when he comes home and shares that he did that, you don't believe him. When the Bible says through presumption comes nothing but strife. I like to put it this way. That's the Proverbs. Here's Adverbs 2:2, Anderson style. Write this down. Assumptions are the mother of screw-ups. Pure and plain and simple. You make an assumption and act upon it, you shall be counted amongst the fools someday. One of the members of our church had a son who went off to college and was going to be an architect. After third year, had some kind of a breakdown. They brought him home, and the guy wasn't functioning at all. In fact, they didn't know what to do, so they called the paramedics. The paramedics committed him for 3 weeks for observation and that. That was about 4 years prior to my meeting the boy. But by the time I met him, here is a bitter, angry man. He never forgave his parents for doing that to him. He really can't function in the world because he sits out back and he talks to communists in the trees. He's hearing all kinds of stuff now in his head, see. But nobody's resolving this for him. And Mom and Dad asked if I would talk with him. So I said I'd be happy to do that. He's eking out a living, basically, by doing some drafting work for some architects in our area there. But he couldn't be an architect. He just really wasn't together enough to do that kind of thing. So Mom and Dad are basically supporting him. He's doing little side jobs, doing some drawing and drafting type work. Well, I spent 3 months with this guy to try to help him to be able to accept himself in terms of his own emotional life. Now, here's a person who loathed his parents. I'd say, how do you feel about your parents? I love my parents. He hated his parents. Ask his parents. Well, why did he love his parents? Because the Bible said you love your parents. Now, he wasn't going to our church. He was going to another church in our area that take the most idiotic, fundamentalistic, right-wing caricature of a church that you can think of and go two steps further to the right, and that's the church he was going to. I met the pastor in that church one time. I absolutely couldn't believe it. If that was Christianity, I'd walk away from it today. I haven't done this most legalistic, controller, complete controller person. Did a wedding one time in our church, in his church, and he was the wedding hostess because he wouldn't turn it over to anybody. When I came to my part of prayer, he set a mic up over on the other side of the room. He said, you pray over there. He's a sick man. But a fundamentalist. Don't get me wrong, I believe in the fundamentals of the faith. But I don't believe in fundamentalism like that, and I hope you don't either. Here's a basket case of humanity. No freedom whatsoever. Bound. But this poor guy could not admit. I finally got to the point I said, would you agree with me that it's possible now, mind you, for a Christian to feel the emotion of hatred? Well, maybe, but not me. When I got that close, I never saw him again. Now, that is not as uncommon as you may think it is. But you will never resolve that problem with that person's life until he is able to be honest with himself about how he truly feels. Speak the truth for members of one another. That's part of speaking the truth. We're oftentimes honest verbally, but emotionally we're incredibly dishonest. which is tremendously unhealthy. So it's dishonest. Through presumption comes nothing but strife. Well, let's look at another possibility. How about indiscriminate expression? I like Peter in this area. Peter's the John Wayne of the New Testament, a real door slammer. And he goes around, boy, it's no problem telling other people how I feel. In fact, I call him the one-legged apostle because he had his other foot in his mouth all the time. But you got to love him for that. I mean, you know at least where he stood with Peter. Well, here's old Peter, and he's about to make the greatest confession of all time. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And a few minutes later, he's in league with the powers of darkness. And the Lord had to look at him, get behind me, Satan. And then they go out in the Mount of Transfiguration. And Moses and Elijah appear in three tabernacles. And Peter, oh, this is great. Let's build three tabernacles. Boom, the other two are gone. And a voice comes down. This is my beloved son, you know, Peter. And here he is in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the whole Roman army's coming. What's Peter do? He pulls out his sword and cuts off the ear of the servant of the high priest Caiaphas. Jesus reaches down, picks up the ear, and puts the ear back on. Didn't he do that? Put your sword away, Peter. And then to see that kind of impulsive, you know, indiscriminate expressor come under the power of the Holy Spirit and be the leader of the church. Amazing, isn't it? The transformation that took place there. Peter, Lord, with you, I'll go anywhere. You'll deny me today three times before the cock crows. And he did. And he did. Indiscriminate expression is unhealthy for the other person. The first one's unhealthy for you. You say, oh man, I'm glad I got that off my chest. Yeah, you just blew the other person apart. You may feel better, but you just destroyed the other person. And there's a lot of instruction in Scripture about being slow to anger, for instance, slow to speak, and learning to deal with our emotions. See, God nowhere ever condemns us for the way that we feel. He says, cast your anxiety onto Christ. Now, how are you going to cast it onto him if you won't admit you have it? Or be angry and sin not. Go ahead. Be part of humanity here. But learn how to do it in such a way. If you want to be angry and don't sin, be angry the way Christ did. Be angry at sin. You turn over the tables, not the money changers. So it's unhealthy for others. How about acknowledgement? Acknowledgement. Let's start first of all here with God. If you have your Bibles, I'd like you to turn to Psalm 109. Psalm 109. David is under intensive pressure. He says, O God of my praise, do not be silent, for they have opened the wicked and deceitful mouth against me. They have spoken against me with a lying tongue. They have also surrounded me with words of hatred and fought against me without cause. In return for my love, they act as my accusers. But I am in prayer. Thus they have repaid me evil for good and hatred for my love. Now listen to his prayer. Listen to his prayer. Appoint a wicked man over him. Let an accuser stand at his right hand. When he's judged, let him come forth guilty. And let his prayer become sin. Let his days be few. Let another take his office. Let his children be fatherless and his wife a widow. Let his children wander about and beg, and let them seek sustenance far from their ruined homes. Let the creditor seize all that he has, and let strangers plunder the product of his labor. And let there be none to extend loving kindness to him, nor any to be gracious to his fatherless children. Let his posterity be cut off, and the following generation, their name be blotted out. Oh my gosh. What's that doing in the Bible? That's nothing but pure hatred, isn't it? Ever feel that way? Do you ever pray that way? Should you? What's this doing in the Bible, man? This is the authoritative and inerrant word of God here. Well, I'm here to tell you that's exactly how he felt. This is some of the hard truth of Scripture. Theologians struggle with this passage. There's several that are in here. They wonder, what in the world is this doing in here? You say, you shouldn't talk to God that way. Well, wait a minute, folks. I got just enough theology to realize that God already knows that about me anyhow. Doesn't he? He knows the thoughts and intentions of my heart. He knows every motive within me. What value is it then to express that? Is there any value in that? Well, I'll tell you what, if you've got that kind of a father, or you can dump that kind of hurt and hate in your own soul, there's a very good chance you aren't going to have to live it out this way. But I don't believe this is an obscure psalm here. I think David, who had a whole heart for God, had such a real, vital living relationship with the Father, he could tell him exactly how he felt. Does he stay here? No. That's what I love about the Psalms. He may dump some poison and some hurts and some frustrations, but even probably writing it down under the inspiration of God himself, he comes to the point, help me, O Lord my God, and with my mouth I will give thanks abundantly to God. He ends up in a mode of praise. I had a young lady drove down from someplace. She came primarily to talk to me about a difficult relationship with her mother, but we really spent more time talking about her. And she had a roommate up in this college where she was at. She just would get to a certain point and just blow off steam. And I was talking about her inability to express herself, especially emotionally. So I opened up this psalm here and she said, "You mean what I do is right?" I said, "What do you do?" "Well, I get to a point after a while, I just get in my car and I drive down to this next town and I scream and holler and shout and kick and do everything. And then I drive back and by the time I get back, I'm okay." I said, "It's probably better you do that than take it out on your roommate." But I think there is some health to that. I think that there is, if we had in this lifetime one or two or three others of whom we could be that emotionally honest with, we would live very, very healthy lives. You have somebody like that? Every Christian has God like that. Every Christian has that. Where I can pour myself out to God. There's just like a great big release valve there when you can do that with God. I have had people telling me, seminary students say, "You can't talk to God that way." I really believe that's a faulty concept of my relationship with God. First of all, he already knows that. Well, you're asking them to do pure poison. Well, I got to admit to what he's asking for here in terms of his prayer is not very noble. But it's real. And any movement that makes me real in order to be right is going to be blessed by God. Because if I'm sitting here feeling that way, but expressing to God a bunch of pious platitudes, do you think that's going to turn God on? And like I said earlier, he's going to make you real before you can be right. Now, I thank God that we have a way of discharging those kind of things with God. And I'm amazed at times how so many people think that they've got a little thing over here that God doesn't know about in their life. Or I shouldn't bother him telling how I really feel about those kind of things. Do you feel that way as a parent? If you knew that your child had certain things that he didn't want to bother you with, but you knew were very important with him, how would you feel about that? You say, "Son, listen, everything's important. Every question's an important question. The only one that's wrong is the one you never ask." We say all those kind of things, but it's true. And we in our humanity know that. How about God? See? Now, part of our problem in this area is that in learning to respond to people in terms of where they are at emotionally and where we are at emotionally. Let's look back at Job chapter 6. Job, by the time he gets out of chapter 2 or so, has come to the end of his long suffering. I mean, he's kind of had it. In fact, he's cried out now. He wished he had never lived. Well, one of his friends comes along and suggests that's not a very good thought. And you know the whole story of his friends are trying to convince him that something he had done was wrong and that's what caused it all. And it is not a very mature thing for you to be crying out to God here, wishing you had never were born. Well, Job responds to him. But I want to look at verse 24 here. Job 6:24. He says, "Teach me, and I will be silent. Show me how I have erred. How painful are honest words. But what does your argument prove? Do you intend to reprove my words when the words of one in despair belong to the wind?" Let me tell you one of the most helpful things I can in ministry. You don't respond to a person's emotions with words. You respond to a person's emotions with emotion. You weep with those who weep. You rejoice with those who rejoice. When somebody is in despair like that, what they say is irrelevant. It is of the wind. Doesn't make one difference what they say. All you need to do is to realize that it is a way of expressing how intensely they feel at that time. You're sitting here beside somebody who just lost a loved one, and they turn around and look at you. There were saints up until that point. And they turn around and look at you and you say, "Why did God do this?" Don't answer the question. Number one, you don't know the answer. But number two, don't respond to the words. Respond to the emotion. All the words do in that anguish and that expression, the striking out, is to communicate to you, "I'm hurting awfully bad right now." And that's what you respond to. You weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. I got one of those telephone calls that every pastor hates in the middle of the night. Somebody's son was in deep trouble and he may not live, and can you come to the hospital? It was a great family. Great family. Went down to that hospital sometime about 1 o'clock in the morning, sat out there in the waiting room with just by ourselves. Occasionally a nurse would pop through or something like that. Hoping for the best, fearing the worst. 4 o'clock in the morning, we heard the worst. Father, mother, and myself, doctor came out and said we lost him. I was a young pastor. I was so tired anyhow. We'd been up all night, basically. And we had shared together and we'd prayed together. I never felt so stupid in all my life. I didn't have a thing to say. I just sat there and cried. That's what they did. I went home with my tail between my legs. I felt, gee, nice job, Anderson. You know, you sat up here all night with him and didn't have one good thing to say to him. Well, for totally unrelated reasons, they left the church. 5 years later, they came back. Stopped by the church, took me out for lunch. And they said, "We'll never forget what you did for us." You weep with us. That's what Jesus did, didn't he? When Martha and Mary came running to him, "Lord, if you'd only been here." And he saw them and the despair they were in. And what did? He cried. That's what he did. Looked at Jerusalem, he wept. It's time to weep. You'll never know what you'll do for people if you allow them to be emotionally real. Sets them free. That's why we have funerals. Provides a safe atmosphere where we can grieve. It's part of it. You acknowledge it. Part of our humanity. It's part of our reality. It's part of God, for that matter. It's not a non-divine thing. God feels, too. You see, here's Jesus, and he comes down in that Garden of Gethsemane. And he's about to take all the sins of the world upon himself. And his 12 are down to 11 because one forsook him. And he pulls aside Peter, James, and John and said, you stay and wait with me. And the flesh is willing, or the spirit's willing, the flesh is weak. I had to wake him up twice. He said, I need you. He said, I'm grieved and distressed to the point of death. That's emotional honesty. And I'm telling you, dear people, if the Lord of the universe needed that, what about you and me? I think the Bible talks about 3 is an ideal number here, that where we can go to and be real with some people and tell how bad we hurt and where our joys are. You see, Paul never liked to travel alone. He wanted Timothy or Silas or Barnabas or somebody with him. Jesus had his 3 and Job had his 3 and the Trinity is 3. But I think that even what secular psychologists are saying is that it's hard to be mentally healthy today without one person of which you can be emotionally honest with. Now, how do we acknowledge those things? Well, let me construct a scenario if I can. Suppose I come home today and I call before I drive home and say, hon, I'm going to be home by 5:30 or 6. I say, can you have dinner ready? Because I got to be someplace at 7 tonight. And she says, okay. So, I've had it though, however. You know, it's been a long day. Let's say, it was compounded by a bunch of tragedies. On a scale of 0 to 10 emotionally, I'm a 9 or a 10 when I walk in that front door. I mean, I'm really stressed out, tired, physically, emotionally exhausted. I walk in the front door. Hi, babe. Dinner ready? No, I'm sorry. You know, I'm, for crying out loud, I called you. That's why I want dinner ready at 6 o'clock. She goes, why are you mad at me? How come you're mad at me? Am I mad at her? Am I mad at her? Nah, I'd have kicked the dog if it was there. Didn't make any difference. See, I was mad when I walked in. On a scale of 0 to 10 emotion, I was there. Right at that top. Any little thing would have set me off at that point. Any little thing. Now, suppose, however, I walk in the front door. Hi, babe, dinner ready? No, I'm sorry, I didn't have time, I said. I am really kind of at the end of my rope right now. I'm exhausted mentally and physically, and I got to turn around at 7 o'clock. That's just being honest with her, just telling her where I'm at, see. Ooh, 2 important things can happen. Number one, she's off the hook. She knows I'm not mad at her. And I'll tell you what, that's critical. That's part of speaking the truth, for we're members of one another. She's off the hook. And 2, she can meet my need. Listen, I'll keep the kids off your back. The dog, go back in the back bedroom, kick back. I'll have dinner ready in about 15 minutes or so. We'll get you out of here. Now let's change it around. Same setting. Hi, babe. Can you have dinner ready at 6? I'll be home. I got to leave at 7. Sure. So I walk in front of the door. Dippity-doo-da, zippity-yay. Hi, babe. Dinner ready? What do you mean, dinner ready? You think all I got to do is cook for you? The kids have been on my back all afternoon. Whoa, hey, wait a minute. I'll come in the back door. You know, what did I do now? You know, let me try this again. Wrong house. You know, and play all the stupid little games. And you know, she mad at me? No. She's probably mad at the kids. No. Same setting, you walk in. Hi, babe, dinner ready? Neil, I've had it. I've had it. This happened and this happened, and I just really at the peak right now. You know what it is, folks? It's McDonald's time. Hey, hon, that's all right. I'll take the kids down. We'll get some food down the park, play with them a little while. Now, I'll tell you when life is difficult, when you meet at that front door and you're both 10. Can I ask an interesting question? That doesn't happen very often for me. It's a strange thing. I've noticed that when one is up, the other one seems to be down. Or it seems like when one is a 9 or a 10, the other one was at a 4 but decided to be a 2 in a hurry. All of a sudden their problems are melted away compared to the other one, you know. And I don't think I'll bring up my gripe right now. How many found that true, by and large? It's, you know, Now, life can be very difficult. That's when you just turn around and go back to the office, and she goes back to the bedroom, and you decide to start life again tomorrow. But it doesn't happen that much, and I'm thankful for that. You know, how long has it taken me to learn this? I'm still learning it. I'm still learning it. But it is not a loss of my manliness to be honest about how I feel. In fact, I really come to a conclusion a long time ago. It takes a lot more courage to be honest and real and face up to who you really are and recognize that is just part of who we are today. And God, I think, would have us to say, you got to start there. You have to be real. And if we deal with that, now if you're not real, I want to make you real. That's humility. He says, hey, I'm opposed to the proud. Well, I ain't got any problems. I got them all together here. I don't have any emotions. I don't feel anything. Pride. That's all it is. That's all it is. I think part of being humble today is to bring us to that point where it's okay for me to be Neil Anderson. It's all right to be real. God's not going to ask me someday, why weren't you Billy Graham? He'll say, why weren't you Neil Anderson? It's who you are. It's who I created you to be. And whatever life or gifts or intelligence that I endowed you with, you'll be accountable for, because I'm a fair God. I gave you some more than others. I gave some others more than you. I did that. You just be what God called you to be. That's okay. The other aspect, I feel, in this emotional management here is to know our own limitations. That's kind of critical. You need to know on a scale of 0 to 10 where you're at. If you're at a 7 or 8, it's not a good time to resolve life issues. So, when you get into that kind of contest and personal relationships, and we're going to resolve this right now. I'm not going to leave until I resolve this issue. Well, if you're that emotional, you're not going to resolve anything. Somebody's going to get hurt. You're going to say things you'll later regret. You're far better off to simply say, listen, if we keep talking right now, I'm going to get angry. Don't say you're making me angry. That's my response to it. But you're acknowledging that, see? And you're recognizing your limitation. Can we eat first and talk about this later? That's wise. You say, well, wait a minute. Doesn't the Bible say not to let the sun go down on your wrath? Yes, on your wrath. They can go down again and again on the problem. You can resolve it tomorrow. Next week, next year, say, listen, tonight's not a good night, I'm tired, or I'm hungry right now, can we eat first and relax a little bit and then we'll discuss the issue. Boy, some of these people who just force things through, we're going to deal with this now. They'll just destroy relationships after a while. And everybody has emotional limits. And they're different for every person, and they're different every day for you. One day, you couldn't hurt me or cause an emotional reaction on me if you wanted to. Boy, another day, you just take a little trick to set me off. And if you know that, see, now you're managing your life. You're not setting yourself up for a fail. I'll tell you how subtle it can be. I realize, as every husband does, the first about 10 years I was married, there was that little segment of the month when life was not quite as profitable as it was the other segments of the month, living with my wife. And it suddenly dawned on me that here she keeps this meticulous record of that monthly cycle. You know, she's probably got it from the times she first started that old cycle. But that most women do that. Well, I had no knowledge of it. I'd go over here and fill out my calendar and schedule and everything else. I'll never forget one night, it just kind of hit me. I said, you know, I ought to know that because that way I can plan maybe to be around more or back off pressure-wise. So I said, hun, you know, I've never seen your record in this area. I know you keep one. I said, but what if you told me that? And so when I make the next month or 2 month plans, you can tell me and I'll back off or try to be home more than I normally would during that time. What do you think my wife did? She's beginning to cry. She really did. You know, just the fact that I would even consider that. I don't even know if we actually put that into plans, but just the fact that at that time, in the moment at least, I was sensitive to the mood swings that she has in life. And not to look down at her as a point. There is no way a woman can go through that cyclic change like that and discharge that amount of blood and not affect you emotionally. I mean, you don't feel guilty about PMS. It's life. You just learn to live with it. You learn how to manage it and work it out in your relationships and know what your limits are and you back off. Well, I can't do as much right now because this is how I feel. It's okay. That's managing it. It's managing your life. We need to take a break. And then what we're going to do is to look at another aspect of our emotions, things that have been left over now from the past. Because what we've been talking about primarily is things that happen currently to me. What happens, however, if I've got major trauma experiences in my life today because of an event 10, 15 years or so ago, which is common? Is God giving us a way to deal with that, to resolve that? So I'm not chained to my past anymore. I'm not just a product of my environment. And I think the answer to that is emphatically yes. That there is a way that God says that I can be freed from my past. But we need to understand that and how it's interplaying in our life today. Because that's an important concept of our life. So let's take about 10-minute break.